So, good morning. It is the 29th of October. We are here talking to Andrew Davidson. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning. At the FCIC offices are Ron Borzakowski and Mike Easterly, and on the phone we have Mr. Davidson. Just for the record, do you agree that we can record this conversation?
Yes, I do.
Fantastic. I'm not sure what you know about the FCIC. As a word of introduction, we were formed by Act of Congress and signed by the President back in the spring of 2009 and owe our report by December 15th of this year on the causes of both the financial and the economic crisis. And in doing so, we were talking to hundreds of people, gathering documents and doing a thorough investigation. And as part of that, I think we'd like to talk to you this morning about a whole bunch of topics. We saw the articles you sent. Thank you. So I think for the easiest way to do this is to start in the earliest history and then just march forward, if that's okay.
Yeah, that sounds fine.
One thing that, because I've been looking at the articles you've read and parts of your book, one of the things that I'm trying to understand, and I don't well, I have to admit, is the early evolution of securitization in the 80s. The earliest mortgage securitizations, and then moving into the 90s. And in particular, if you could run through any of the history, I'm curious about the changing nature of credit enhancement in these deals, and understanding sort of how it changed from bond insurers to the senior substructures we've seen and things of that sort.
So I don't have an exact recollection of the history, but I'll give you sort of a general idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I started working at Merrill Lynch in the mid-80s, I think, like around 1985 or so. And at that time, most of the securitizations were of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae loans, so with full government guarantee. And then most of the non-guaranteed loans or securities were traded in whole loan form. So we actually had a pretty substantial whole loan trading desk at Merrill Lynch. And so those we would buy loans directly from a bank, typically a thrift, and then sell them to another bank, primarily as loans. And sometime during that period, we started to securitize those loans and trade them as these, private pass-throughs and senior subordinated structures. And the original senior subordinated structures we actually called 90-10s. And so those were 90% senior, 10% junior. And in some cases, the junior class was kept by the originator. In some cases, we kept it. In some cases, we sold it. But the senior class was generally credit enhanced to a double A level, and let's say it was just one big subordinated class. So that went on for a while, and sort of grew through the 80s and 90s. There actually were some initial failures of some deals right around the late 80s. There were some deals out of Boston, I can't remember, maybe Guardian,
mm-hmm.
but that failed due to, bad underwriting and fraud and a variety of other things that are sort of reminiscent of the recent experience.
What was the collateral in those early 90-10s?
So a lot of, it was a combination of some fixed rate, some adjustable rate loans. So this was pre-subprime loans, so it wasn't, the 228 subprimes, but it could have been what we would have considered either prime or, like in the case of those Guardian deals, Alt-A type loans, some sort of reduced documentation loan.
And I've read somewhere there were some seconds that were thrown into there, maybe. Is that true?
Yeah, there may have been some seconds as well. So I don't have exact memory of what those deals were. But, they failed miserably, and then they were sort of, re-securitized or resold later on.
No, by failed, you mean, I'm sorry.
There were just tremendous losses.
Okay.
So, so that the senior class took losses.
Right, and the investors would be taking those losses, not the underwriter.
That's correct.
Okay.
Do you remember when the bond?
So, yeah.
No, please.
Go ahead.
No, let you just keep running through the history, because I think, I mean, because what I read is starting in about 92, I'm wondering if it's a fallout from these early deals going bad, the bond insurers start insuring that the 90 part.
Yeah, so the various kinds of insurance were used over time, so that there was, mortgage insurance that was, generally any loan above 80% LTV would have mortgage insurance on it.
Mm-hmm.
Basically as a carryover from sort of Fannie and Freddie standards. And so there was generally mortgage insurance. In some cases, some of the mortgage insurers also provided pool insurance, where they would sort of be a more general guarantee. And then there was also bond insurance. And the use of those features sort of varied over time, but generally as you got into riskier assets, there was sort of greater and greater use of the mortgage insurance, the pool insurance, and bond insurance. But as deals started performing better, the investors sort of relaxed, or the investors in the rating agencies relaxed their requirements for that type of insurance. And so generally, if you were like a new originator, you required some additional either bond insurance or mortgage insurance to get the deal done. If you were a more established originator with some track record, you required less of that type of insurance. So the market developed that the prime deals started having less and less of their insurance. The market sort of bifurcated, roughly around that time between what was called prime and called ABS, or home equity loan.
Mm-hmm.
And that distinction still sort of exists in Intex, where they separate prime deals from non-prime deals. And the prime deals are supposed to be loans with underwriting that generally matches, FHA, the Fannie and Freddie type underwriting guidelines, supposed to be low risk, generally full documented loans, generally below 80 LTV, the higher FICO scores. And then the subprime was sort of everything else. So it could be the low documentation loans that would fall into sort of the all day category, or the actual subprime, which originally were mostly fixed rate, low loan to value ratio loans to people with prior credit, prior delinquencies on their loans, or otherwise bad credit. And then those were grouped together in like this area generally called home equity loan, or ABS. And there's not really a sensible distinction. They were all mortgage loans, but they were separated either because of the originators or who the investment banks were working on the different types of deals. And so they started to have different structures and institutional framework developing over time.
Is this the early 90s?
Yes.
This split?
Yeah, this is sort of as we get from the middle 90s to sort of late 90s. And then, sort of late 90s, we then had the failure of the specialty finance companies again.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, Conti Mortgage, and they were probably the biggest, at the time, United Companies. So those were loans, largely fixed rate loans, made to borrowers with bad payment histories. They were, some of them had credit enhancement, some didn't have credit enhancement. The biggest problem they ran into wasn't necessarily fraud, but that they were just sort of aggressively pricing the loans into the market, and then they put these, they retain the residual pieces, the first loss pieces, on their balance sheets, and they book them on their balance sheets at very inflated levels, often sort of 2 to 3 times what the actual economics would have been. And the way they were operating as companies, they really needed rapid growth to sort of offset the payoffs of these securities or their declining values. And so they just dropped all their underwriting requirements so they could rapidly grow. And so that whole industry, you know, blew up around 10 years ago.
And so off to this 97, 98 blow up of, so this is Money Store, this is Conti, Amresco. Are these all still sort of roughly 90-10 structure with various kinds of credit enhancement?
Well, I think by then the structures were had many more. You know, we were no longer in the 90-10. So through the 90s, they started to tranche much more. So they started to have what they call the six-pack. And so the six-pack would split that 10 into sort of a variety of classes from, you know, a double B class up through a double A class, so they created a junior set of junior bonds and a set of mezzanine bonds, and then the senior bonds would also be tranched. So even during that time, the deals were getting to be a little bit more complex. The credit enhancement levels were dropping, and instead of a 90-10, where the 90 was a double A, the highest class would then become a triple A.
Okay.
And like I said, some of those issuers, especially the newer ones, did have some bond insurance, some didn't. There was a, you know, a wide range of sort of credit enhancement techniques used during that time period.
All right. Because I've seen some references to, you know, somebody saying the first senior sub deal was 97, and that seemed just too late on some level.
No, that's much too late. I think the first senior sub deals were in the late 80s.
Okay. Could be just a terminology thing. If they don't call the 90-10 senior sub.
Yeah, there may have been some other shifting of interest structures. And, yeah, so the structures evolved during that time period. So it may have been the first of some particular type of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Was in that time period. But there was definitely some form of senior subordinate structures earlier.
So what do you see happening following the finance companies and the specialty companies dropping out? Which you said we're still pretty much doing these fixed rate, lower LTV, you know, traditionally B and C kind of lending. Coming out of that, Wells buy, First Union buys Money Store, HSBC buys one of the companies, Citi's buys Associates, and at the same time, I think we start seeing sort of the more modern incarnation of subprime. Do you remember the
Chase bought Advanta too as well?
Mm-hmm. So how did that morph? You know, what was the thinking behind going from the older version of B and C to, I guess, what, you know, led us from there through the crisis, the 228s, the greater reliance on ARMs, the higher LTVs?
Well, you would think that the market would have learned by then that this was not a safe product. And, you know, it's sort of, to me, it was all sort of fed by the fact that we had this, you know, boom in housing prices. And so we started to create these loans. You know, so some of those guys continued their, you know, subprime lending. And the losses early on were, you know, quite low following the sort of prior blow up. And so I think that gave people, you know, more confidence to continue to doing loans to you know, troubled borrowers. There was certainly some idea that we had some, you know, a substantial unbanked population in this country, and that these products were allowing the mortgage companies to reach borrowers who otherwise weren't being served, and say the performance was good. But as home prices continued rising, that segment of the population could no longer really afford the fixed rate loans that would have supported subprime, which, you know, were fixed rate, generally high down payment. And given the good performance, people started to just relax those requirements. You know, so I don't know who introduced the 228 product. You know, there had always been some products around, you know, sort of vaguely around for a long time. But, so I know, like, for AmeriQuest, it became a big product, and later on for Countrywide, it became a big product, and New Century. But I'm not really sure who was sort of pioneering or pushing that product. But we got into this situation where those originators, sort of the, you know, New Century, AmeriQuest originators, sort of teamed up with Wall Street so that they were originating the loans and Wall Street was packaging and selling those loans into the market. And given sort of the demand for spread during that time, there was just tremendous demand for these products. And it became clear that the investors were looking less and less at the actual underwriting quality. And in order to get borrowers into these products, you had to create, you know, something that had sort of a low enough starting coupon and a high enough LTV, or you know, various forms of down payment assistance that sort of allowed the borrowers to continue to participate as home prices rose. And you know, the term that people used at the time was affordability products.
Right.
Which now probably sounds, you know, sort of scary. It's a euphemism of some sort.
Yeah.
But the idea was to sort of expand these affordability products, and that as homes got less and less affordable, you would adjust for the affordability in the mortgage, because you couldn't really adjust people's income. And during that time, still losses were incredibly low. Right. So California, you know, which is where this was going on, and it was largely linked to sort of home builders and new neighborhoods. Prices were soaring. And so you saw very little delinquencies. And what you saw in delinquencies rarely resulted in losses. The 228 products would turn over, essentially at the two-year point. And so it looked like there was, you know, essentially no risk associated with them. And meanwhile, you know, basically any shortfall in income was just being refinanced the next round. So everyone was doing sort of cash out refinancing every 2 years and just sort of continually re-leveraging the system as these as home prices rose.
And that was the purpose of the structure, right? I mean, to force that refinancing.
Yeah, you know, so in some ways it's a sensible product from a, you know, credit management standpoint, which is you have a product whose interest rate rises, you know, at a certain point, and so by then either the person had credit cured, right, so they've demonstrated that they can make 2 years worth of payments, in which case they should be able to get a lower cost mortgage, or if they haven't done that, then you know this is a risky borrower, and we should charge them more and recognize that we're that this is going to become a, you know, loss mitigation management servicing issue. And, you know, so presumably that 2 year reset would segment the population so you could focus on the good borrowers versus the bad borrowers. And while that might have been a, you know, reasonable theory, if you had continually rising home prices and you allowed people to refinance despite their credit ability, all you were really doing was re-leveraging the entire system.
Do you remember sort of when this is happening? Because there is, in the early 90s, a rise in subprime DQs and foreclosures through, in the early 2000s, I'm sorry, in 2000, 2001, probably peaking in 02, from that last generation. So there's some history.
This is all good.
I'm sorry, but there's just some history of seeing these things go bad, right? Probably that
in, yeah, so they had gone bad before, right? That's why if you look back at history, you know, you would have thought they would have gone bad. But, 2002 to 2005, if you look at the loss numbers, they were very, very small. And, some of the Wall Street firms and other analysts were starting to try and segment out actual defaults and implied defaults, and look at the severities because you realize that a lot of these borrowers still had bad payment ability, but they were just being bailed out by the rising home prices. And so the actual severities in California, which is, you know, the largest piece of this, were, which is very small, the loss severities, I can't remember the numbers offhand, but, you know, in the 10-20% range.
Okay.
This is the loss given default.
That's right. So the defaults were low, and then the loss given default was low as well. But it was basically because there was, so the home prices had gone up so much that there really was no reason to default, or if you did, you could sell that house very rapidly. And so the system was just much too much focused on the short-term behavior and not on sort of long-term risks. That, you know, this idea that home prices, you know, could never fall on sort of a national basis, it sort of was capturing the imagination at the time.
All right. I think we wanted to let you go up to the present, but if you're done, we have some follow-up questions.
Yeah. So we can then, you know, get to sort of how things fell apart. But I guess another sort of important component during that time period was the growth of the second liens of various sorts, either the simultaneous seconds and silent seconds, etc., and sort of the view of the rating agencies and the investors that you could just look at the first lien, and as long as that was like an 80% LTV, that that didn't result in increased risk, even if the borrower had a 100% LTV loan, and. Yeah, that was just a completely wrong idea. Look, I can't even figure out where that came from or why it was able to.
Okay, that was my next question, was why would they think that?
Yeah, I can't even imagine any justification for it. Yeah, it sort of came out of the idea that before, in order to get a loan over 80, you needed to get mortgage insurance, and that mortgage insurance, especially for borrowers with bad prior credit, is fairly expensive. And, you know, so you say, okay, well, we should just be able to do like a 90% LTV, charge more interest. And the investors would say, okay, well, instead of mortgage insurance, we'll just demand an incremental return. For some reason, the market didn't go that way because there was this, like, strong idea that first lien shouldn't be over 80 LTV without mortgage insurance. And somehow the first lien investors were convinced that an 80-15 or an 80-20 didn't change the risk of the 80. It only changed the risk of the 15 or 20.
Right.
I say it's just incomprehensible to me how that happened. It never made sense.
It's just for clarification, this was in the mid-80s, the seconds?
Well, this is really, you know, there had always been some seconds.
Right.
This is really in the 2005 period. 2003 to 2006, 2007, that these, you know, alternatives, 80-10-10, really started to be viewed as an acceptable replacement for mortgage insurance. Like I said, they'd been around a while before, but not that big. So it was like something in either the investor psychology or the rating agency approach or some anti-mortgage insurance tendency of the investment banks, you know, led to this. And I say it's sort of incomprehensible to me.
Right. And is there anything else we need to know to take us from 2003 to the crisis?
Yeah, so I think the one other, you know, crucial ingredient that's sort of in that piece that I gave you is the growth of the CDOs, these mezzanine CDOs.
Mm-hmm.
So that prior to that time, you know, we had people who would invest in subordinate classes as sort of a business, but they were essentially mortgage people with underwriting experience, and they would carefully review the underwriting practices and performance. And even at some points, they were even allowed to say which loans they would allow or wouldn't allow in a transaction. And so that the subordinate buyers were providing discipline to the investment process.
Right.
With the growth of these mezzanine CDOs, largely invested in triple B classes, that discipline just broke down. That these investors really didn't have that much of their own capital at risk. They wanted to create very large deals very rapidly. And so they were just buying the subordinate classes essentially without any significant analysis, relying entirely on the rating and sort of the spreads available in the market. And if you talk to the rating agencies, there are people on the structured finance side that say, well, it was never really our job to do the due diligence for the subordinated investor. And really what they were trying to do is protect the senior investor, and they thought the subordinated investor would protect themselves. Right. On the other hand, they had these, you know, CDO groups who were basically just saying, you know, as long as this deal is rated such and such, you know, as long as it's rated triple B, it's going to count towards this deal and its collateralization, so you can relever that triple B without any additional work.
Right.
So I think this is, you know, a giant part of the problem, that there was no one whose job it was to make sure that these deals were well constructed and that there was credit discipline and that the performance was likely to be good.
All right. Can you explain how that, did that filter back down to the origination stage?
Well, I think it filters back down because these originators, there was tremendous pressure on them from Wall Street to produce volumes of loans because they could sell them. So any loan you could produce, no one cared what the quality was, you're going to say, okay, I'm going to have higher and higher volume, and I'm not going to worry so much about, you know, whether or not the person lied to me when I allowed them to have a stated income loan, or whether or not this appraisal was good or bad, or whether or not I got all the documents together correctly. Because you say, I'm just going to be able to sell that, and, you know, if there's a problem down the road, we'll worry about it later. And so you have this, you start to go to a volume-driven mentality rather than a quality-driven mentality. And with no one checking the quality and everyone making money off of volume, you're going to very rapidly deteriorate the quality of the business.
Right. Did you have a question, Ron?
No, please.
Okay.
This is
going back from to the 80s and even before securitization, when you were selling whole loans, did the type of investor in participating in this market change? I've heard stuff about insurance companies being in the market early on and doing more due diligence. I've not been able to sort of verify. And then, you know, does that change over time, the composition?
So, you know, by the time I started in the mid-80s, the insurance companies were already sort of a fading presence in the loan market. And so most of the trades that I recall us doing were between smaller savings and loans to larger savings and loans.
Right.
There might have been some other investors, but basically both sides of the trade were in the mortgage market, and it was really some institutions seeking liquidity of some sort. So even when you did this trade, that the person who was buying knew, you know, a fair amount about mortgages. They could have originated similar loans themselves. And so you certainly had, you know, sophisticated buyers and sellers, at least as far as credit. Both sides were relatively unsophisticated as to interest rate risk management, but the buyers and sellers were both fairly sophisticated as to credit. So I've jokingly told some people that my memory is that when we were doing those whole loan sales, or even the early securitizations, Merrill Lynch would send out a due diligence team and get back a due diligence report. And, you know, if even a handful of loans came back with, like, a missing signature on a document, even if it wasn't, like, the note or the mortgage, or, inconsistent signatures, like some with middle initials, some without middle initials, that we would go back to that originator and say, you know, you're just not up to secondary market quality, and if you really want to participate, you better start producing better loans. And the best loans were the ones that were sold, and the ones they kept were the loans which were bad in one way or the other. And then somehow that whole discipline seemed to have vanished from the industry.
Right. So how did it change over time, the investors?
You know, we started going, instead of having the investors, you know, directly involved, there was sort of this growing reliance on the rating agencies, you know, sort of documented in various ways. And, you know, for the senior investment, which is probably fine, but then even the junior investment stopped going to sophisticated mortgage players, you know, sophisticated credit mortgage players, with their own underwriting and due diligence capability, to, you know, CDOs and other B-piece investors who are investing based on rating and some, you know, cursory analysis, not based on detailed loan level analysis and review of underwriting capacity.
Okay.
CDO basically disintermediated the sophisticated credit investors.
So between selling of whole loans and the CDOs, who were the investors? Were they pension funds? Were they, I don't know,
other hedge funds, other specialists in mortgage risk?
And did that change over time?
So there was a period when, you know, we had these specialty finance companies retaining their residuals, which obviously didn't work out very well. But in the higher grade, there was a variety of REITs and just sort of other specialized investors. You know, it could be hedge fund type investors. Some of it could have been, you know, had insurance companies. You know, so I know some insurance companies that were buying some B pieces directly. But we moved from sort of the direct purchasers of those classes to these CDO purchasers. But I'd say REITs and insurance companies and some other private pools of money were sort of pretty common investors.
This is sort of late 90s to the 2003 CDO boom.
That's right, yep.
Okay. That makes sense.
A firm like Redwood Trust, which still exists now, Redwood Trust, you know, would buy the loans, and then they would do a senior substructure and keep the subordinated bonds and sell the seniors. So that would be a healthy way of engaging in that business.
Now this is very helpful because we've heard about and read a lot about the original residuals being held, and that makes sense. That's the traditional skin in the game, except they blew themselves up with the overinflated values. And that gets us to about 98, 99. Then there's this gap as to who's really taking the credit risk in the 99, 2000, 2001, especially on the subprime side, where the market's growing rapidly. It's being dwarfed by the refi boom for prime borrowers.
Right.
But it's still growing, and it's before the CDO steps in about 2004. So it's helpful to get your information on this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, there was a paucity of investors. Those bonds were extremely cheap during that time period, but that sort of did attract these, specialized investors.
And then when the CDOs enter, of course, they drive prices up and spreads way down.
That's correct. But even worse than that, they just ended the due diligence.
Right. So you were doing due diligence in-house at Merrill Lynch?
So Merrill Lynch had I was in the research department, but we had a small due diligence team, and then we would also outsource due diligence as well. So, you know, we'd either hire a firm or send our own team of underwriters.
And this is all before the days of TCPIP and the internet. So when you mean send underwriters, we're talking about, you know, you're sending somebody out to the small thrift. They're going through loan files. They're checking them one by one before you do the secondary market purchase.
That's exactly right. Yep.
It's a far cry from sending over a loan tape and examining a 1 in 10 sample, which is what we kept hearing was the modus operandi in 2007.
That's right. You know, we went to visit I had a small investment fund during some of this time. We still have do some investments for some clients. We went to visit one of the large investment banks about their mortgage program, and we said, oh, can we see your underwriting guidelines? And they said, oh, we don't have any underwriting guidelines. I said, well, then what's your program about? They said, well, we underwrite 100% of the loans. I said, what does that mean? They said, oh, well, we take the originator's guidelines and we make sure that the tape matches the originator's guidelines. And they said, oh, that's great. Can you give us the guidelines of, you know, the three or four largest originators you work with? And they said, okay, yeah, we can do that. We must have it somewhere. And then we said, but we also noticed in your prospectuses that you say that, you know, some percentage of the loans are exceptions to these guidelines. And so we said, could you also send us the list of allowable exceptions? They said, oh, we don't have a list of allowable exceptions. We just have them marked as exceptions. So, well, can you at least tell us what the trade-off was? You know, what the exception was and, like, what the violation was. They said, we don't track that either. And then we said, well, how many loans fall into that category? And they said, oh, it could be like 30-40%. We said, well, why don't we just skip the whole exercise? We don't need to actually see any underwriting guidelines or anything else, because it's clear that there is no underwriting guidelines or policies or anything else. So, just incredible. I hadn't really been involved in subprime for a few years, and I just couldn't believe the level that it had deteriorated to.
I take it you didn't buy the bonds.
We didn't buy any bonds. We encouraged our clients to, you know, start using the CDS to short. even that created some other difficulties. But, we just couldn't see that any of these things made any sense at that point in time.
And this is 06 or 07?
I'd say middle of 05 to middle of 06 kind of time period.
So even the middle of 05, you'd have this conversation with the Wall Street Bank and realized that it had sort of underwriting had just fallen away?
That's correct. Yeah, even by September of 05, the general consensus among sort of the research people was that the subprime market was going to fail at some point, and that losses, you know, would be far higher than what was built into the transactions. But, you know, what was built into the transactions then was about 5% lifetime losses. And I think most analysts would have thought that lifetime losses would have been about 10 or 15%, not the 30 or 40% we're seeing now. So there were a lot of us who were bearish, but I'm not sure there were too many people in that time who thought this would lead to a sort of complete collapse of the economy.
So when you think subprime, is it literally a subprime product, or do you loop into that some of the Alt-A product based on the no-doc, the low-doc, the IO and payment option arms that were coming up online at that same point?
Well, so this, when I said subprime, I meant, you know, specifically subprime.
Okay.
We also have never been a fan of any option arm product. That those products might be fine as sort of IO products at low loan-to-value ratios to very high net worth individuals. But when you start to take a negatively amortizing product and start calling it an affordability product, my view is that that's just leading to a potential disaster, that you're basically giving someone a loan that they can't fully afford, and you're counting on sort of home price appreciation to bail you out, and the negative amortization just sort of makes that worse and worse.
Right. And I realize it wasn't your department, but the due diligence at Merrill Lynch, what sort of percentage of the loans do you think that, or did you have a sense of what they were doing?
You know, I think it varied. That, you know, in some cases they did sampling, and in some cases they would do, you know, almost a full review. But, you know, since it was so manual, I don't, you know, I I think it was, you know, a sampling of, you know, 1 to 5% or so. But if they found, but the standards were so high that if they found like even a few mistakes, they would say, oh, well, either we're not doing that or we're going to have to do a much more extensive due diligence to decide which loans we're going to take or not take.
All right. Did you have? Okay. In turn, you know, you can have these loans to finance consumer purchases, you know, sort of cash out, or you can use it to buy a house. Do you have a sense of whether that the proportion of each changed over time? I mean, for instance, in the late 80s, early 90s, the money store to me implies that these are consumer loans, but perhaps basically, what is the proportion, do you think?
Right. So, you know, the initial term, you know, that in subprime, they call these things home equity loans. And the initial money store were really, you know, take out some money for some other purpose. So they weren't for, you know, they're generally for a specific purpose, and that was sort of the dominant use. And some of them were revolving and some were closed end. And then this closed end market, which, you know, at some point was like mostly closed end seconds, became closed end firsts, and grew from, you know, 10, 20% LTVs up to the sort of 80% LTVs, and it sort of morphed into this sort of subprime lending market for just financing homes and refinancing and, you know, supporting people's general financial needs. But, you know, it was still called home equity loans for a long time. You know, no one calls it that right now, but the name sort of stuck even though the product had changed.
Okay, and when you say it was the dominant use, you mean in the entire market, not just the money store?
Yeah, so the early money store, that kind of loan, and what was called home equity loan, was primarily what you would think of as, you know, seconds, closed-end seconds, for particular purposes, you know, particular non-housing purposes, or could be for a loan modification, it could be to buy an RV, but it was, you know, generally for, you know, some particular need, not to buy a house, but it did morph by, you know, even by that 98-99, most of those first liens were already home purchase loans. And then certainly the later ones, the 228s, were all, you know, general financing of purchases, very closely tied to, you know, new developments and home building.
So really this is a slow 1990s kind of transition.
We're in 1990s, it was more of, yeah. In 1990s, the home equity loan was more of home equity loans for, you know, not for debt purposes, not for housing purchase.
Right,
because by the late 90s, and certainly into 2000, that was a relatively small portion of the market.
Okay. So that's the slow transition from the 90. I'm trying to think, you know, so when does Inside Mortgage Finance start tracking, you know, subprime securitizations? It's 93. HUD starts keeping its list of subprime lenders in 93. And it's from there through the late 90s that you see this transition from the closed, open and closed end seconds more and more to becoming a first lien mortgage product.
That's right, yep.
Okay.
And I think, you know, there is this sort of history because of that, as I sort of mentioned earlier, as to why they're sort of split in the sort of investor community and in the Wall Street community, is that second liens, whether they're, you know, closed or revolving, were not considered mortgages. You know, they weren't handled by the same people who did the first lien mortgage lending, you know, the mortgage finance people. It was done by the asset-backed securitization people who also did, like, manufactured housing and, you know, maybe some credit card lending. And so the two markets sort of had a separate upbringing. And I guess it's even true with the rating agencies that they're sort of, they've always been somewhat split. in how they were viewed and managed and underwritten.
Okay, but the loans were originated by the people who were also doing the home purchase finance, is that correct?
So originally it was two separate sets of originators as well. Right, so for example, Countrywide didn't enter that second lien home equity loan business in any large way until much later. You know, they morphed their business pretty dramatically. But it would have been more like the Money Store on one side, or Conti Finance on one side, and Countrywide, Wells Fargo on the prime side.
And do you remember, just
one more question on old history. You mentioned the 90-10s and that subordinated structure late 80s, I guess, just as you're moving out of whole loan sales into that. That's about the same time, right, that the original structuring on the corporate side comes along, right? The Drexel CDO deals and the like?
I'm not really sure on that.
Okay.
Maybe too much of a mortgage guy.
But it is, so the first, I'm just trying to, the first mortgage security.
It's definitely roughly the same time,
yeah.
That sort of thing, but I can't sort of really think of it.
I'm trying to understand a little bit of the transition from the earliest CMOs, which are simply tranched to match timing, the preference of different investors for different timing of payments, right? The original, the first 83 CMO. And it seems like this 90-10 structure tranching for credit is a few years after that. That's the only thing.
That's definitely correct. So, the first Freddie Mac CMO, I think it was like 83 or something.
Yep.
Was that time period. And like I say, at Merrill Lynch at least, the desk was dominated by whole loans before it started moving to these pass-throughs. Now, some of them were participations where you would sell off 95% and someone would retain 5%, what they would now call sort of a vertical slice. And then the structure didn't really make much economic sense. It was very inefficient. And then we started sort of switching to this, there's some people who want credit and some who don't want credit, and moving to that senior subordinated structure. But yeah, that's definitely a few years after the interest rate tranching.
Okay, and how do you model these, the value and the default risk and all of that with all of these strange products? And you'll have to excuse me for my ignorance. I'm not a statistician, but I understand these things have fat tails, and that's very difficult to deal with statistically. Could you sort of give a dumbed-down version of how this was done, both early on and more recently?
As far as the credit risk or the prepayment or just the general risk?
All of them. Credit, prepayment, and valuation, I guess, as well.
Yeah, so, let's see. Yeah, so certainly there's been like a major changes in how credit analysis is done over the last few years. Prior to that, I'm trying to think, describe what's going on. I don't think people thought too much in terms of sort of distributions of outcomes and fat tails, et cetera. But the general approach was to look at a pool of loans and over the lifetime figure out what proportion were likely to default. And then, at least for the rating structures, just take some big multiple of that to protect the more senior classes. With some analysis, trying to take similar loans and how they performed either during the Great Depression or during sort of the oil patch turndown, so in the late 80s. And if you look at the regulations for Fannie and Freddie, it sort of had this scenario-based approach. And so we didn't really know too much about fat tails or anything. It was just sort of look at the average case and look at a super stressed case.
Right, and this is for the securities.
As long as loans were This
is at the security level, not at the whole loan level.
Well, even at the whole loan level,
I would think that would apply less to the whole loan level, the whole fat tail idea. But if you have a subordinated tranche, that becomes more important. So I'm wondering, what sort of adjustments would be made.
But I say, it's like you didn't really think about it in terms of tails, because all you really thought about was like, well, how much do I lose if, the economy keeps chugging along? And then, like, what's the worst case? And the worst case is the depression, so that's already the tail. So there wasn't really much thinking in terms of probability distributions and means and modes and skewness, et cetera. That approach, is pretty simple. It should work pretty well. The only thing is it doesn't work if the loans that you originate don't match the kind of loans that existed during the stress environment that you were testing for.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, at least until recently, the number of participants in the market who had credit data was very limited. So basically, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac had the data. I guess FHA had the data, but I don't think they did much with it. And the mortgage insurance companies had data on the loans that they guarantee. And then some of the banks have data on their own loans, although the banks generally weren't very good at collecting and processing their own data. So that the world of sort of credit knowledge was fairly small, and so people were very dependent on the few players who had them. The rating agencies started to develop some models based on, some limited amounts of data that they would get from the originators, or they would just be people who had worked on loan modeling sort of somewhere else and brought over some of that expertise. So everything was very delegated to sort of these few players. And so the fat tail correlation issues don't really arise until later, when we start getting into the sort of CDO world. And so the CDO world sort of says we can put together a portfolio of assets and sort of statistically say what's the likelihood of them all failing at once, or how diversified are they. And it turns out if you're in that world, then all of a sudden, these distributions that you assume and correlations, especially at the extremes, become very important.
Right.
And once again, the rating agencies chose some assumptions that were pretty much indefensible about how volatile these distributions are and what the correlation between the assets is. They just assumed correlations that were much too low and volatilities that were much too low. And my view is that was transparent to the outside. People talk about how the rating agencies needed to disclose more. They disclosed what their correlation assumptions were and like what their loss scenarios looked like. And if people had cared, they could have looked at those and determined that those assumptions were just much too optimistic.
And do you think that was deliberate in terms of they knew better but they wanted to get the business, or do you think that they actually believed in those?
So from the rating agency side, my view is that some people probably believed it, some didn't believe it, but if you are like a large corporation, like a rating agency is, and you have these two analysts who come to you, and one says, our method's all wrong. If we do this, these are going to blow up. It's going to destroy our reputation. We've got to stop this business immediately. Or we've got to change our criteria, but if we do, we'll probably have no more business because these other guys aren't changing. And then, so the managers say, oh, we should probably consider that. And then another analyst comes in and says, I understand, Joe's concerns, but, I think if we just make some adjustments here, we adjust our criteria, we move these features a little bit, we can still rate deals that make sense. You know, we may not rate as many, but we can be, you know, much more assured of the quality of our analysis. That it's pretty hard for any corporation to say, let's shut down the business. They're going to say, okay, well, let's go with this guy who seems to know what he's talking about.
Right. And outside the rating agencies, was your opinion shared by many, or did they, I mean, in terms of the people who are expert in this kind of thing?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, most experts would have shared that view at the time. You know, we were surprised to see how the CDO business could continue the way it was. But our view is that it also meant that investors were complicit as well.
Right.
You know, that they liked buying these high-rated bonds with very high yields. They knew that they probably weren't as safe as other similarly rated bonds, but they didn't know how much riskier it is. They wouldn't have necessarily had the tools or even cared to figure it out, figure out, well, if everyone else is investing in them, that's fine. We're making a little more money.
So who's buying? So that leaves the only sort of the check, parallels to the check we discussed earlier, the check on really poor correlation assumptions in the CDO models is whoever's buying the lower tranches of the CDO's bonds.
Well, it's actually sort of the opposite in the CDO market, because if the correlations are assumed to be too low, what you can do is buy the junior classes and short the collateral. And it's called a sort of correlation trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the end, we saw some hedge funds doing that. They would buy the junior class, and they would use that to fund the purchase of shorting the underlying collateral. And if it turns out that there was a higher correlation, the underlying collateral would perform poorly and would more than offset the amount of money they lose. So it's really the senior investors who need to be the ones concerned about the correlation level.
Is it your impression that the correlation trades are driving a substantial fraction of the junior CDO purchases?
You know, maybe at the very end it was. I don't think before then. But certainly towards the end there was, you know, it's, you know, it's hard to tell for sure, but there was pretty sizable discussions of that type of trade, you know, in the 2006-2007 time period.
Okay, I'm trying to think earlier, a little bit earlier, the, you know, 2000. If I go to 2004,
no, I don't.
Yeah, do we know who's buying them in 2004?
Before that, I don't think so. Yeah, before that, I don't think it was. You know, basically what was going on is that the other CDOs would buy those junior classes from CDOs. So it was just sort of getting recycled through the CDO market.
And as long as you had investors buying the higher rated tranches simply based on the rating, the machine keeps moving.
That's right. And then the CDO managers were sort of in these contracts where even if the equity didn't perform that well, they were going to earn some management fees. So they weren't really taking the risk of the junior classes, even if they retained them.
Okay. Because it is, I think, we've discussed a lot of, I think, what you have in your 6 degrees of separation paper, I think, that you sent us and that we've seen before, that somehow the natural gatekeepers' checks on the system all seem to have broken down to varying degrees, from the rating agency models to the investors that are supposed to be most concerned about credit risk.
Right. I would still be honest that they broke down, that there were, like, deliberately engineered to avoid them. So.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So my view is, if you're, you know, either an originator or a Wall Street firm, you know, that your job is to find investors who will, you know, buy your bonds, and you know, no matter what they are. And so if you can alter the structure a little bit and bypass the investor who's going to have the more due diligence or require a lower price, you're happy to do that. So I'm not saying that, like, someone woke up one morning and said, oh, how do we create a market that doesn't work? The natural tendency is to try to cut out the players who care the most and sell it to the guy who cares the least. And if every time you do that, you get to be a little more profitable, you're going to, you know, move in that direction. Sort of a the natural tendency of the market to you know, find its way to the, you know, least least discerning investor.
And presumably, in a world where supply, where demand is going to exceed supply a little bit, they're going to set a price.
Yep.
So, do you have a, is there anything else? I mean, I think I have one other set of questions I'd like to ask you and discuss with you. Are there any other issues that, as the commission, we should understand or particularly highlight in the report or be particularly aware of about the securitization chain and how it changed in leading up to the crisis?
You know, so the other thing that I think I read a little bit about in that, and I've done a little bit more work on recently, is sort of on representations and warranties. So the question is, why didn't representations and warranties work? And, you know, now we're seeing these sort of giant lawsuits on putbacks and et cetera. But, you know, my view is that the way representations and warranties worked is that they traveled through the chain of ownership of the loans and were sort of a guarantee from one participant back to the from the current participant to the next buyer, and that it wasn't really a very good process for ensuring quality of the loans at origination. For example, if the chain of reps and warrants gets broken, then the first guy isn't on the hook at all. The guy who sold you the loans, if he's the third owner of the loans, he really doesn't know whether or not the loans were underwritten correctly or poorly. He's just relying on a prior representation and warranty. And so that system, which was established when it was transactions between one savings and loan and another savings and loan, should have been re-engineered when securitization was started. And so what I favor is, I think I call it an origination certificate, where the originator of the loan, the person who funds it, makes a set of representations and warranties and some sort of affidavit that's backed up by some sort of financial responsibility. And that's a document that travels with the loan, so it's sort of like a bearer note of some sort. So if you have that certificate and there's a violation of a rep and warrant, you can go back to the person who originated the loan and say, I'm going to hold you responsible. You still have to make sure that they have enough money to stand behind those obligations. And then I also think that there should be penalties for violations of reps and warrants, even if it doesn't lead to a loss right away. Mm-hmm. So right now, reps and warrants are enforceable by repurchases. But if you notice a flaw in a loan document, but it doesn't really affect the marketability, there's very little cost associated with that. So I think there should be fines or other costs tied to bad underwriting that when you did the initial due diligence on the package, you could go back and say, okay, well, we did the due diligence and here's your bill for bad loans you gave us.
Even if they hadn't gone bad and there's no material loss.
That's right, even if there's no material loss, yeah.
So is this another case where you think there is a path of least resistance? So, you know, there was a fork in the road way back when, at least from your research thinking about this, that there was a more rigorous rep and warranty structure that got pushed out by the people that are willing to sort of take this one-off, I only deal with the person behind me kind of structure? Or is this something the markets didn't think about as it grew very rapidly in the early, you know, late 90s, early 2000s? They just adopted the old system to the new one, somehow collectively missing the flaw.
Yeah, I think it's more that the system was designed for like one-on-one transactions and then was extended to securitization. And, yeah, people didn't really realize that there was a flaw or that it had to be addressed, you know, in some different way.
You don't remember anyone standing up at a conference saying, look, guys, we're using this old system, it ain't going to work?
Yeah, I don't recall anything of that sort. Yeah, reps and warrants are saying that, you know, now everyone in the world knows about them, but, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, my guess is that, you know, there might have been, like, you know, a couple hundred people in the world who knew about them.
Well, you were one of them, right? Because the story you told about going to the Wall Street Bank said, wait a minute, you have a rep and warrant here. How do you know that the loans even come close?
Yeah, I've done, so I sort of knew it from two things. One is because I was worked with our whole loan desk when I was at Merrill Lynch. So when we did whole loan sales, you know, we reviewed the reps and warrants. So someone taught it to me when I got to Merrill Lynch. And then I was involved in a litigation case where the servicer went bankrupt and, but had made some, passed on some reps and warrants to a subsequent buyer. And it was pretty clear that this breaking of the chain of reps and warrants was creating a giant problem because the person who owed the loans only had assurances from this now bankrupt entity. And they had no way of tracing back to the originators.
And what year was that case?
You know,
I mean, roughly.
It was a while ago. It was like 10 years ago or something.
Do you remember the names of the litigants?
I could probably remember their exact names if I focused on it. I can't remember if it's public, not public. You know, if it was settled, it was in bankruptcy court. So I guess that's public, right?
I think so. I'm not a lawyer, but bankruptcy, yeah. Bankruptcy should be public.
You know, let me figure out what's public and what isn't public from that.
That would be great. And if it's something you can disclose and send to us, that'd be quite interesting as sort of a, you know, antecedent to some of the things we're seeing now.
Right, that's sort of outside of securitization, but it's, like I say, it informed me of this issue of the reps and warrants. So.
In the other piece, switching gears a little bit, in the other piece you sent us, you look at the valuation of particular tranches of a particular case study deal to assess, I can see based on the timing of the report exactly why, the market price versus the sort of model price you'd come up with on a couple of other measures.
That's correct.
And it makes me think, so what's your view of accounting, mark-to-market, the role of those kind of issues in the crisis? Let's just start with the big picture question.
Right, so that's really what this was just going to get us to talk about that issue. So, you know, so if you have mark-to-market accounting, mark-to-market accounting is going to reflect two things. It's actually going to reflect one thing, which is the market's view of where someone's willing to transfer that set of cash flows or instrument to another person. And that might or might not reflect what the actual losses on that security might be under, you know, some scenario or set of scenarios. And for certain types of institutions, especially those whose job it is to intermediate risk over time, putting them on mark-to-market basis is just going to create volatility in the system, you know, and that's going to be, you know, I guess the other buzzword now is pro-cyclical. And so if you want to reduce the impact of market and liquidity shocks on the system, you can't use market values. You have to use some other measure, which, you know, is going to be less objective, but might be more accurate. And so, you know, I think mark to market is good. I think people should know the market value of their instruments. And if market values fall significantly, the firm should, you know, let the investors know that the market values have fallen significantly. And if it's a result of an actual credit event, that should be reflected in their financial statements as a loss. But it would be good to split apart the portion of the credit loss that's associated with sort of likely credit losses and also changes in liquidity or risk premiums. And so in the end, you know, FASB has now essentially adopted a rule that reflects that in that if you have these instruments that are other than temporary impairment, which still isn't that clear of definition, but anyway, you know, their market value has fallen, is likely to stay low for a while. You reflect the expected credit losses in your income statement, and then you reflect the additional drop in fair value in other comprehensive income. And so I think that that was a good change. And my view is that that change did a lot to keep the system from further collapse. That I think if you look through sort of history, you'll find that right around the time of the FASB change, I don't know which one it was, 157-E or...
I think that's right.
That that there was, you know, a substantial drop in the volatility of financial institution stocks. It was also right around the same time that the Fed did the SCAP. But my view is that the accounting change had more positive impact than the SCAP change.
So how should we think about the issue that some people have raised with the Commission, for example, that if you look at, even with all the corruption in the securitization pipeline, the number of AAA RMBS, let's leave the CDOs alone for a minute, AAA RMBS or even AA RMBS that have suffered actual principal shortfalls is quite small.
Well, I think that number's going to go up, but I think that's sort of part of this issue. So, you know, that particular deal I looked at, I pulled up some of the prices again today, and it turns out the ones that I showed, the A4 and A5 bonds, the pricing from the pricing service is still in the sort of same ballpark. But the bonds that were right above that, there was an A3 bond that in November of 2008 was priced at 73.9 and today is priced at 92. In our view, is it probably won't have any losses or probably won't have any significant losses. So the question is, what was the right price for, to be reflected on a financial statement, you know, at year-end 2008? Should it be, you know, 100 because it's not going to ever take a loss, or should it be 75 because that's its market value? And so my view is that there are two different pieces of information. They should be used appropriately. But you shouldn't assume that because the price is 75, that means that if the institution holds the security, that it's going to take a loss of 25%. But that's not a reasonable conclusion to draw.
Do you think, so in the height of
accounting systems, so we need accounting and regulatory systems that reflect that. And then further is that when we didn't have a system that reflected it, the forced selling, you know, made the crisis worse. And so the losses kept growing because institutions were forced to sell assets that might never take losses.
In the height of the crisis, one can see that there, you know, there was very steep liquidity discounts. I mean, the example you just gave is a perfect one. Do you think those are still present in the market, or the 92 cents, for example, is sort of a market average for the losses this thing will take given the continued unemployment, the continued macro system, you know, foreclosure crisis that we're going through and the like?
So bonds that might still take small losses, you know, so that they eventually will be downgraded to C or D, probably still have a large liquidity premium. But the bonds that are unlikely to take losses, so would stay investment grade forever, probably only have a modest liquidity discount. Now, we still have a lot of illiquidity in the market, so we're certainly not back to where we were before, but we might have had too little of a liquidity premium beforehand.
So it seems like there's a...
We would say the market's, you know, the market for high grade or good performing instruments is greatly improved. But then home prices aren't falling anymore either, so there's a little more economic stability. So, you know, the problem is, you know, it's hard to make exact statements about what's the expected loss component and what's the illiquidity or distressed premium. And so it's, you know, hard to be an accountant or a regulator during those time periods.
But I'm thinking even today, I mean, we're looking at one case study deal, for example, where the AAA tranche has suffered no impairment whatsoever. It has been downgraded to C. And there's still, I'm very curious, had to even think through, you know, this entity that owns it's written off 16% of the deal. There's no TTI charge. At the same time, you know, who knows how many of the remaining borrowers in that pool are going to continue to, you know, make their payments or eventually get to refi out and make the bondholders whole.
Right. So, you know, the other thing, I don't know, if two or three rating agencies rated it a C, we've seen somewhere it's like one is a C, one is a D, one is a double A. And, but anyway, so someone would have to form a judgment, and we'd have to look at the collateral and say whether or not we think this bond, you know, will experience a loss or how large it would be. But anyway, we can find examples of both kinds. We can find, you know, AAA bonds that will take losses, originally AAA bonds that will take losses of that magnitude, and others that won't, and they could both be priced at, you know, still at significant discounts. So, I would say the bond that's in that rating range, there's probably still a liquidity premium on top of the expected loss.
So this speaks to me that you have a good business potential if your models are better than other people's.
You know, so over the last few years, we've had a lot of clients who've been using our models for these sort of accounting purposes, and we would prefer they're using it for economic purposes, but certainly the demand over the last two or three years has been to deal with sort of accounting and expected losses.
Rather than to either trade off of these or to improve sort of macro forecasts and understanding of where we're going?
That's correct. You know, so we have other clients who are doing that, but we've been had this sort of little consulting business that's grown recently around accounting. We have other people who license our models, and the people who license the models are generally more focused on sort of value and risk measures and sort of interactively identifying value in the market. But the clients we have for consulting mostly want sort of a third party to validate a, you know, lifetime loss assumption.
Is there some other aspect of this?
I guess a good sign is that business is fading because there seems to be less distress.
We can use good signs. Are there other issues about the mark-to-market that you wanted the commission to sort of understand?
No, I think it's just, you know, the general one, which I'm sure had been brought up before, but that, you know, it's just a very complex issue.
That it is. And you also, it's one issue where it's interesting, you get people with almost theological points of view, right? So even stepping off of anything
right,
that's not
right.
The objective market price to some people would be considered almost heresy.
That's correct. Yeah, so my preferred method is that if you're a depository, you should basically be on a, you know, cost-based accounting with adjustments for impairments. And then side by side, you should present a mark-to-market balance sheet. So you really should just have two. But your capital measures should be off of the cost-based, and you can, you know, separately report your mark-to-market to show people what your liquidation value would be if you were forced to liquidate.
And eliminate the uncertainty.
Two different kinds of information. Excuse me?
Yeah, that also eliminates the uncertainty. Part of the issue during the crisis was, you know, who's hiding what and who's not marking to market, and are the marks aggressive or conservative?
That's right. So I just think if you present both, you know, then we can sort things out. So the people who think that mark-to-market is the true present value of future cash flows, my view is they're wrong because there's an uncertainty as to what the discount rate is, you know, how much risk premium or risk aversion is built into that pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not theoretically correct. And so you can't rely on the market price to be the truth. It's only the truth about, you know, what price you could sell this thing at today. And the definition of fair value needs to be improved because there's really no such thing as fair value. Right? There's market values and there's, you know, what we call like intrinsic values. It's hard to say what's fair and what's not fair.
if I put on my economist hat, people say the only fair price, you know, the fair price is the price that somebody's willing to transact at today, which is not the intrinsic value, as you pointed out.
Right. So that's all. So that's all the market price tells you. It's just the price at which you can do a transaction today, and it doesn't necessarily reflect your future prospects of holding that instrument to maturity.
Great. Is there? So are there other issues that, you'd like to raise with us? We've done the securitization chain, and we've done some of the accounting issues. Any other parts of the crisis that you found particularly surprising, interesting, things the Commission should be aware of?
I'm sure there are some. What else is interesting? Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's interesting, but I wasn't involved in this sort of, you know, how the crisis sort of cascaded. Because, you know, my view is the subprime crisis, as bad as it is or was, isn't really of the magnitude to have resulted in the, you know, wider economic crisis. And, you know, so it's sort of interesting to figure out what those transmission mechanisms were, but that's probably a little outside of my expertise.
Do you have...
So anyway, my view would certainly be that the mortgage crisis was, you know, might have been the prime, or someone calls it like the canary in the coal mine, but is not the cause of the meltdown. It might have been the first piece to meltdown, but that the economic system must have been fairly precarious in other regards as well at the time.
Do you have in mind the economic system, or the financial system, and, you know, the iBanking community, other financial intermediaries, that part of the system in which you've been involved?
So I don't know if it was the, you know, investment banks, commercial banks, the shadow banks, the hedge funds, the repo system, the SIVs, the foreign investment in the U.S. I'm not quite sure exactly where it is, because I'm, you know, not quite a sort of a macroeconomist, and I'm not really an expert in sort of financial systems. But it just seems to me that this crisis, although it was large, was not that large relative to the size of the economy. And so it's more of a question of how did that transmit itself, you know, from, you know, bad representations and warranties and, you know, overexcitement in the CDO market into sort of a, you know, general collapse of our financial system.
These are issues we were wrestling with, without a doubt. I don't think we have other questions for you. At the beginning of the tape, I should have asked you to run through a short bio, if you could, for the record. You know, basically, quick educational sketch and a quick few sentence career sketch would be very helpful for us.
Sure. So I have a BA from Harvard in math and physics. Excuse me. Then I went to the University of Chicago and got a degree in, I think it's finance and marketing, but I mostly studied finance. I worked at Exxon in their treasurer's department for 2 years following business school, so that would have been from 1983 to 1985. I then joined Merrill Lynch, and I worked there from 1985 to 1992 in their mortgage-backed securities research department. Over time, I became a managing director in charge of that department and several other related research and analytics groups. I left Merrill Lynch in 1992, and I formed Andrew Davidson Company later that year. We provide models of mortgage prepayment, credit, and valuation to financial institutions, about 150 different clients. In addition to those models, I've also provided consulting services to a wide range of the financial institutions involved in the mortgage market. I've probably worked with most of the major financial institutions and many of the mid-sized and smaller institutions over the time period from 1992 until now.
I was curious about the physics major. Did you have a different career in mind when you were in college?
I had no career in mind when I was in college. I liked math and physics. you know, I don't think I really considered it as a career. I did work at the plasma physics labs at Princeton one summer, and that probably confirmed my desire not to have a career in math or physics. So I went straight from college to business school. Actually, my first job at Exxon was what I thought was my sort of ideal career. So it was a somewhat technical company. It was multinational. I could use, you know, technical skills, finance skills. But it was sort of a stifling environment for me, and I just ended up at Merrill Lynch a few years later when a couple of people I knew from business school said, you know, this mortgage thing is growing. There's a lot of interesting questions we could work on. Why don't you come and join us? So it was pretty much accidental that I ended up in this business.
Hey, Andy, Tom Stanton here. I just came in at the very tail end to say hello.
Oh, hi, Tom. How are you?
Good, thanks. I look forward to listening to the tape, but I don't want to ask any questions because I'm sure you've already answered them.
No, this has been...
Okay, if anything else comes up, feel free to let me know.
We will do that. We're very appreciative for your time and your insight and the perspective. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Bye.